Coming up on Life is a Festival.
It looks like we're going to have a ballot initiative for full decriminalization of a group of psychedelics and another ballot initiative for a regulatory framework coming together at the same time. So that hasn't happened anywhere yet. That's why I said that I feel like Colorado will be the epicenter, because that dynamic, that central tension that's in the movement, there's an opportunity for that to be worked out and find a cooperative way forward. And it's not just about the laws in Colorado. Like, this is about our compass as a movement. This is about the narrative and conceptual understandings and our analysis of what is needed and what's going on here. And it's also about power. And that's what politics are. There's a need to restore trust and restore power to the people, to communities, to make sure that the grassroots movement can really find power with establishment political structures. And I think that that's the mycelial way.
My name is Eamon Armstrong, and this is Life is a Festival. This podcast is a celebration of thinkers and leaders who live their lives with the open-hearted, experimental joy of a festival. Each week, we converse in complete openness, in an ongoing quest to find those boundaries in our being and melt them into lofty horizons. Life is a festival, only to the wise. Hello, my friends and fellow travelers. Welcome back to Life is a Festival, and Happy New Year to all of you. I hope this new year is full of bright, luminous adventures and explorations and all sorts of magical things that you have been hoping and dreaming for. The new year is a lovely threshold for that, and certainly is often the case for me. And I'm excited for some new projects on the horizon that I will share as they blossom and emerge. Today on the show, we are discussing psychedelic decriminalization, which is a big deal this year especially, and the epicenter of this movement is Colorado. So today on the show, I'm talking to Matthew Duffy, who goes simply by Duffy, co-founder of the reform and education platform Spore, to explain and understand Colorado's upcoming legislation, what we need to know about it, how we should think about it, looking at the entire experience through the beautiful metaphor of mycelial networks. Mycelial networks, of course, are the below-ground communication networks of fungi, including our beloved psilocybin. I don't know about you, but I love psychedelics, and I think that they have the power to change humanity, but only if they are held in certain stewardship. Otherwise, they can simply create more inequality as non-specific amplifiers of our existing political conditions. So Duffy is super dialed in about how to make sure that reality doesn't happen with this psychedelic renaissance. So we begin by discussing permaculture, which was Duffy's initial introduction into the mycelial way. And we discuss these networks as an ideal model for organizing political change. We discuss psychedelic decriminalization versus legalization, what the difference is and why the two must happen simultaneously. We review the issue of psychedelic exceptionalism. That's the idea that somehow psychedelics are good drugs and other drugs are bad drugs and other drug users should be penalized. Psychedelic exceptionalism is a pernicious issue in the psychedelic renaissance. And we get into how to re-perspectivize identity politics, which I think is one of the tricky points in all of this, is creating real inclusivity, equity, and access without getting stuck in typical political discourse. Finally, we discuss Spore's upcoming Right to Heal campaign, which is about prioritizing marginalized community empowerment, access, equity, and leadership within the psychedelic movement. And finally, how you, yes, you, can get involved with the upcoming Colorado legislation. So, Duffy, is an eco-futurist, organizer, myco-poet, and co-ecosystem director at SPOR, which is the Society for Psychedelic Outreach, Reform, and Education. After teaming up with Decriminalize Denver in 2018 for the Denver Psilocybin Initiative, Duffy went on to co-found SPOR and enroll in the Resilient Leadership MA at Naropa University, where he completed his master's degree in May 2021. Duffy and SPOR are currently focused on the Right to Heal campaign and the upcoming legislation in Colorado. My friends, generational healing will happen in beloved community. So let's make like mushrooms and get into some radical collaboration.
Duffy, welcome to Life is a Festival.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's very serendipitous how we met here in Colorado, which, as you said, is the epicenter of psychedelic legislation. And you know a lot about a field that is of an area of interest of mine, of course. And I've been very concerned with equity and accessibility in psychedelic medicine. Mm. You bring this wisdom around social permaculture, around solidarity movements, certain philosophical frameworks that I am familiar with the vibe of, but not necessarily technically astute about as much as I'd like to be. So in our initial conversation, I was already wanting to soak up this knowledge. And of course, as a podcast host, wanting to share this knowledge with my esteemed listeners, our esteemed listeners today. Mm-hmm. So it's really an honor to have you on the show. Welcome, and thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity. And I've been seeing this podcast out in circulations for, I think, probably over a year. I honestly haven't tuned in. I'm not a heavy podcaster, but it's been on my docket to hop on. But
wait, you also told me specifically something about not tuning in.
Yeah,
like that you had an impression of what this show was just based on the title. And I think that's actually kind of a fun starting place.
I agree.
What for you when you encountered Life is a Festival and possibly just like maybe the icon of it or whatever? What was it about this that kind of felt like, well, maybe this isn't very serious?
Yeah, and I mean, fuck being serious.
Well, maybe serious is the wrong word, but yeah, I'd love for you to share what that impression was, because it's, I think, quite relevant to what we're discussing.
Right. I acknowledge a bit of a jaded saltiness that I can carry sometimes, and just the framing of Life as a Festival, which is something that I dig. I've seen like eco futures when I'm in my like utopian bends of little like pirate utopias that are kind of like transformational festivals that are these little glimpses of how it could be. And that's part of the emergence of an ecocentric future. And I'm like, oh, it's probably one of these, another like sparkle pants snag podcast that I have developed somewhat of an aversion to what I call light supremacy, which is just simply put the bypassing pulse that is in a lot of new age and psychedelic spiritual community, where there's a sense of unity consciousness, but it always doesn't translate to solidarity work. And not to cast judgment, it's more of a frustration with the gap that I feel between those of us who are having psychedelic experiences and are on spiritual path and don't necessarily, you know, connect that to the collective because of the background of a dominant culture that's very alienating and individualizing. So it feels like a lot of people are just like sometimes shooting for the moon or just following their bliss. And I want us to follow our bliss, and I want us to follow pleasure and joy. And I think that the opportunity that the psychedelic movement has is to make the revolution irresistible. As they say, it's a Tony Bambara quote. And after talking to you the other night and actually meeting you, I was very refreshed to feel solidarity in what your actual intentions are with this podcast and the work that you're doing as creating a invitation with a festival. And I think that's how we're never going to win the wars of like battles of ideology and politics. We win hearts. I think through invitation and through framing liberation and healing as something to lean into as something we should celebrate. It's not all working on our childhood trauma, and it's not all fighting antagonistically for social justice. We actually want to liberate, to be freer together.
Well, you know, Duffy, the bypassing is the key problem I see. Yeah. And it's the idea that we should elevate our consciousness, as in take it above and away, when what I feel like is we need to bring our consciousness to all the unaware spaces. And a lot of healing trauma is bringing consciousness into those traumatized places, into those memories, into the places in our body that we are disconnected from. But of course, where the consciousness is lacking most is in our connection with the other. And what you were talking about the other night, you used the expression queering psychedelics, not trying to win minds through ideology, but winning hearts through real connection. And one of the tools to do that, that you have a lot of experience with, is the perspective of social permaculture. And I think that that may be a great starting place. For our listeners, we're going to go on this journey together of bringing some consciousness to some of these unaware places, including unaware to me, including things that aren't exactly on my radar, though I am somewhat aware. And you have access to some pretty potent frameworks. And, you know, you were talking about Adrienne Marie Brown and her work with pleasure activism. And there are these access points that we have that we're going to get a chance to go through today. Let's start with how you first accessed your awareness of the necessity for solidarity in the context of psychedelics and permaculture. When did you first feel like you had kind of an awakening and a desire to bring your consciousness to those unaware spaces in your own life?
Yeah, my first psychedelic experience, I was 15 with mushrooms, and it just opened me up to being part of this world and to feeling the aliveness of everything. And that certainly played a big part in future psychedelic experiences and where I was drawn going into college, wanting to study environmental science, really ended up focusing on food justice and ecological justice, with food systems really being the center. After I graduated, I taught permaculture for a couple of years in Panama, which is interesting. My first memories are in Panama. My father was stationed in Panama. He fought the drug war. My father was a helicopter pilot, and he would lead missions to fly over swaths of rainforest where there were coca plantations, and they would like dump glyphosate over plantations. There was a lot of other things they were doing too. And so coming back as a young adult to Panama, having a sense of sort of like a karmic lineage there, and wanting to go back and finding a project that really spoke to my heart, seemingly, in its advertisement of the work that I wanted to do, I followed that. And I hadn't had much experience in permaculture before moving out there. I ended up getting my PDC actually with my first permaculture teacher, was Stephen Brooks.
Oh, I love Stephen. Yeah, he's been on the show.
That's awesome. Yeah. I didn't get my PDC with Punta Mona, but I did in Costa Rica with Rancho Masatal. And I loved working with the land. I loved just being opened up to systems thinking and seeing living systems. So not like this mechanistic, but this emergent, organic, kind of oozy, always messy, different guilds spilling into others. Everything is accepting and receiving feedback from different parts of the system. And with a first principle of permaculture being observe and interact. So permaculture helped me. I was also getting into Buddhism when I was younger, but it helped me start to embody and see the world in a way that matched my philosophies, but was still very like up in the mind. Yeah, like interconnectedness, interdependence. There's a difference between reading books and kind of believing that to be true, even knowing it to be true and experiencing it. So I was drawn mostly towards humans in the system. I love working with trees and planting food, and I was never much of a builder, but just considering design for structures and how all these different pieces interact, really fascinating for me, but I was always most compelled in looking at the human system. Stephen Brooks said in an early permaculture workshop that I had with him, he said that the problems are always in the ego system, never the ecosystem. And that always stuck with me. I just felt also just naturally more compelled to look at these human issues and wonder why, you know, in this place that I was teaching and learning permaculture, why is it that this group of people who are coming from all these different places were not really able to create a culture that really felt like it could hold something that could be sustained in its regenerativity? I saw that as fundamental to the key limiting factor and for us to really create beloved community together. We don't have the cultural practices often to sustain a lot of the eco-villages and intentional communities that we try to create together, which I think is part of our process and returning to certain ways of life that we romantically want to bring back into the fold, and also moving forward and how can we live harmoniously with the planet. And it's in that process, in those attempts where we're healing and we're seeing all these things that need to be composted within us and interpersonally. We can't techify it. We can't just have a master plan for a food system and the technology that's going to regenerate the planet on a biochemical level without addressing this really necessary alchemy that needs to take place within us and within our relationships from what we're still holding on to from generational trauma. So social permaculture is more focused on human systems. And it's a little bit, I guess, redundant because permaculture already addresses people. It's just placing more of an emphasis on the people part and applying permaculture to movement organizing, community organizing, not necessarily just food systems and homesteading. And we need ecological frameworks everywhere. We need to be able to understand ourselves as part of nature, that everything that we do, no matter how mechanistic or man-made, we're here, we're part of this. And it's really just about designing so that we have good form, so that the things that we create are with the Tao in solidarity and in a synergistic relationship with the land, with our relations, with community, with our economics, so that we can really live in abundance and create flourishing communities. I think the psychedelic movement has a profound opportunity to catalyze that, but it will take work to really integrate not just our personal psychedelic experiences, but this sort of consciousness into our communities. And I think that with social permaculture being applied to psychedelic movement, that's how we can really start to create our collective set and setting for the integration of psychedelics, which is, it's the psychedelic movement is potentially a mega dose to collective consciousness.
So I have been blindly confident in the past around the psychedelic movement as a kind of panacea for the ills of dominant culture. If we just had all the world leaders sit in an ayahuasca ceremony, everything would be fine. You know, I've heard people joke about putting LSD in the water in the Middle East. The psychedelics will do the work, right? And when I was first really getting deep in my own medicine work and having that beautiful experience of unity consciousness. It just seemed like, oh, well, this is all just going to be fine. We just need to proliferate these medicines. And then as I've gotten deeper into the psychedelic movement with my work with Maya and doing the Psychedelic Therapy podcast and just becoming aware of how this movement has been progressing over the past few years, it's really smashed my Pollyanna perspective around psychedelics. And when I think about psychedelic medicine entering the mainstream, within the structures of kind of late-stage capitalism, the way that I've come to think about it is that if these medicines help us heal trauma, help us be more creative, and therefore help us be more effective within a capitalist context, and they are accessible only to the privileged, instead of being a revolutionary tool, they actually widen inequality. And, that to me is...
Terrifying.
It's terrifying. You know, Jamie Weil has done a great job of kind of sounding the alarm about this and issues with corporatization of psychedelics. Mm-hmm. And it's happening right now. Mm-hmm. We're in it right now. And the work that you're doing with Spore and with some of these legislative initiatives that we're going to get to, I see as a really potent counterbalance. And so let's get into a little bit around how you were working in permaculture. Now you're in a very, you know, prominent role in psychedelic legislation and psychedelic medicine. And I think a through line is perhaps your perspective on mycelial networks.
Yeah.
And utilizing, again, this ecological perspective to create something that's in some ways an antidote to the kind of capitalist psychedelic exceptionalism and exponential growth, VC-backed psychedelic companies. That sort of terrifying future. We can look to the plants, in this case, perhaps the fungi, to give us a model to counter that. So I know that this is a big ask.
Great.
For you to explain
good.
This. But yeah, let's get into that. And I know that you're well studied in liberation movements and how they can kind of intersect with where we're at in the psychedelic movement now. So let's talk about mycelium.
So mycelial networks are the brunt of the organism, fungal organism, and they connect forest floors, they connect ecosystems through synergistic relationships. So mycelial threads, roots, the mycorrhizal relationship between mycelium and plant roots create this synergistic bond where plants are sharing sugars in exchange for nutrients that the mushrooms break down with acids that the fungal system can only break down. There's an exchange of information, and the mycelial network operates as, you know, basically like an internet to transfer information and resources throughout an ecosystem. It even happens when there is something catastrophic happening, like a fire. Trees will send signals through the mycelial system to make the rest of the forest aware, and trees will deploy defense mechanisms once that signal is sent out. Another really cool thing that mycelium does is before sending out the root, its hyphae to penetrate the cell wall of plant roots, they will send a signal and wait for consent. They will actually wait to receive a signal back for this invitation to make this connection. So mycelium is so amazing as it gives this model for moving at the speed of trust, which is something I grabbed from, you mentioned Adrienne Marie Brown earlier. That's like a basic tenet that she prescribes for emergent strategy that's really based in culture and relationships first, not just what is the tactic, what is the goal. It's focused on creating these really solid, trusting relationships. That's what mycelium does, and it does so synergistically. And mycelium also colonizes, which I think is funny. And in this conversation, I think decolonial work, which has a huge presence in the psychedelic movement, that this is rematriating work, that this is decolonizing work, or it might not be truly healing. Like, it could be bypassing and just on that light supremacist utopian sort of bent if we're not really addressing what's here. And mycelium colonizes two, it just does it well. It does it in a way that is cooperative and synergistic, and it's transformative, but it's not extractive. It's not dominating. It's consensual. So I think that as a framework for how we can organize offers a template for emergence and evolution and progress and all the things that we want. You know, we want to thrive while also composting what needs to die and what needs to be turned in and healing and remediating. Mycelium and mushrooms also are perhaps the best remediators for toxins in an ecosystem.
So how has this mycelial perspective influenced your work coming from permaculture into your work with Spore and the decrim movement?
Yeah, so I moved to Denver in 2018 and heard that this campaign was happening to decriminalize mushrooms. And that's a whole story in and of itself, how mushrooms guided me here. As soon as I heard about it, I signed up and went to a volunteer recruitment meeting. And as I got more and more involved, I saw how naturally these mushroom people were organizing in this mycelial way. And we started to say mycelial organizing, one, because it's cute, it's like deeper than grassroots, but it was also true to what we were embodying. And it was very relational. It was very just emergent. Most of our conversations were, how do we continue to create this network community that can create a whole new ecosystem? That was the first decriminalization of a psychedelic substance since Prohibition. And the actual vote came through in May 2019, and Spore came out of that campaign. And then Decriminalized Nature, they came in Oakland right after that. And we had no idea with Denver how quickly this would take off all over the country. And Decriminalized Nature has really been leading a lot of the local decrim efforts around the country.
So yeah, just some clarification there. So the Decrim Nature movement, that wasn't originally like the Denver Decrim movement.
That's correct.
That came out separately out of Oakland, and there's kind of a coordination for national movements through Decrim Nature.
Yes.
And has that kind of incorporated the original movement in Denver, or are they kind of parallel processing?
We're in community, and we've been working with local Decrim Nature chapters and Decrim National chapters recently, talking about what can happen in Colorado statewide. But yes, so Decrim Nature, which is based out of Oakland, but is spread all over the country, they were inspired by what we were doing in Denver, and they found that we're in Oakland, you know, Denver, they might have to take it to a vote to really get the people out. But in Oakland, we have city council members who sit in ceremony. I don't know if that's actually true, but I kind of think it is. And they just went through their city council and passed a resolution. I'm pretty sure it was unanimous. And that was a much easier route than a ballot initiative. But with a ballot initiative, it's you're really engaging people in the sort of democracy I feel like we want, which is participatory. And through advocacy and education and really, you know, having that grassroots movement, there's a lot of culture shifting and just awareness building work that's really exciting, that's really empowering for communities through a ballot initiative.
Another point of clarification here. This is decriminalization. This is not legalization.
Yeah.
And it's in a local level, not a federal level. So what does that effectively mean for psychedelic use, both medicinally and recreationally? And obviously there's a beautiful gradient between the medicalization, religious exemptions. There's like a whole
right.
patchwork of ways in which this access to healing is possible. But just to be clear, decriminalizing a substance does not make it legal, and it's certainly not legal on a federal level. So what is the actual change culturally that happens when a city resolution or a ballot initiative leads to the decriminalization of psychedelic medicines?
Yeah, so decriminalization takes away criminal penalties for an act that was prior deemed illegal. And on the local level, it's impactful, but it's more, it more has symbolic impact. How it actually functions is it's completely deprioritized in law enforcement's duties. No resources can be allotted to policing and persecuting the possession of mushrooms in Denver, and more than just basic possession, but also cultivation. And they're expanding it to include sharing, the Denver resolution right now. But that's just local law enforcement. So if a state trooper is, you're in the perimeter of Denver on the highway and you get pulled by a state trooper, that the state has not decriminalized. Legalization is around the regulatory framework. Legalization addresses commerce and will be needed to create the regulatory medical therapeutic framework. What's crucial is that psychedelics are also decriminalized before they become legalized and regulated, so that people's relationships for personal use, communal use, are protected, so that that access to psychedelics isn't only restricted to the medical therapeutic framework. So the work around the country to decriminalize is essential, and it's urgent, because suddenly there's this huge push for regulation. Psilocybin is FDA approved for research as a breakthrough treatment for treatment-resistant depression. And with everything that is changing around the mainstream narrative around the medical therapeutic potential for psychedelics, just the ramping up for regulation is happening. Decriminalization happening before that will be key in making sure that there is the broadest, safest, most responsible access and stewardship of psychedelics, because that can truly only be held in community. So, and no one should be going to jail for having mushrooms or having LSD or having ayahuasca or any substance.
And let's drop into the psychedelic exceptionalism right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, let's go. Moment.
Because no one should be in jail for
any drug.
Any drug.
No.
And this is something that we really need to get in alignment as a community about, because psychedelic exceptionalism is super fucked up. Amen. Seriously. It's yeah. exactly this.
It's supremacy.
It's like, okay, well, so I'm sitting in an ayahuasca ceremony and it's a good drug. Mm. But then if someone is using crack cocaine, and there's all sorts of reasons why they might be using that substance to deal with their trauma, that should then be penalized. This is, again, widening this gap of inequality. It's taking one kind of population and being like, well, their drug use is good and right. safe and elevating. Right, right. And so how is the work that you're doing, some of the decrim movements, how are they kind of meeting this issue of psychedelic exceptionalism? Because I know that they dropped ketamine off of the California bill.
Yeah.
And that was a controversial thing,
and
too.
And LSD, they also.
LSD as well? Yeah. Okay, I haven't tracked it exactly, but I know that what drugs are being included and are considered natural, like for decrimming nature, there's a tricky thing here.
Right, yeah. I've been having this conversation for a while, and it's been more and more frequent lately, because we're talking about statewide policy reform in Colorado and what's going to be left out, what's going to be excluded. And so there's the meeting the limits, especially with policy, of like where the world is. That I think that's an important part of the psychedelic exceptionalism conversation, specifically just recognizing that while what you're saying is true, psychedelic exceptionalism is a form of supremacy. It's utter bullshit. Nobody's drugs are better than anybody's. And it's really not about the drugs. It's about, I'm better than you. That's what it's about. The drug war was never a war on drugs. It's a war on black and brown communities, and it's a war on consciousness, and it's a war on impoverished communities. So we have to have that awareness. Otherwise, the psychedelic movement will be a privileged movement that is perpetuating the dominant cultural harms and separation that we want to address. And at the same time, not every substance is the same. So while psychedelic exceptionalism is very real, there's also, you know, this risk of moving into something like a drug universalism, where we're treating everything the same, which is not, I don't think, what we really want to do. We can't, every drug, just like every person, has a different makeup. So there is not a blanket solution for what to do with drugs. Blanket solution, yes, for ending the drug war, decriminalize all drugs. No one should be going to jail for drugs. As far as how they're stewarded and regulated in communities, yes, it's, you know, mushrooms are not the same as cocaine. The psychedelic movement being in solidarity with the movement, the broader movement to end the drug war, is key. And this will be part of the maturation of the psychedelic movement, the movements being called to task to step up and not be so exclusive and exceptional. And, you know, the access that people have had to psychedelics as opposed to other substances is largely based on privilege too. There's a disparity of access already in the underground. And part of that is how the policing has happened and just many social inequities. So yeah, there's the work that the psychedelic movement can do to start creating alternative paths that start to render the prison industrial complex obsolete. The psychedelic movement can really, once and for all, really help prove there's no actual need for people to be going to prison, that there we can create more compassionate solutions. I mean, right now it's just where people are being thrown away because society doesn't have the infrastructure and systems to deal with them. So it's a cheaper solution in a certain framework, but it's really not. It's devastatingly costly on so many levels, not just economic, but it's destroying communities. It's destroying lives. And it's wasting so much beautiful human potential, but not even about potential. It's just human dignity.
So the other night we spoke a little bit about some of the challenges of the current climate of tribalism and the confrontational nature of identity politics and how exhausting it can be to be butting heads in the same way over and over again. And it seems that psychedelics, the psychedelic movement, can take a different perspective. As we're starting to get into the conversation about the right to heal, mm-hmm. I'd love to just zero in a little more deeply on the way that when held correctly, and we've talked about how it can be held incorrectly, but when held correctly, psychedelic healing in relation can, in a sense, overcome, sidestep, or re-perspectivize this confrontational identity politics. Because that's, I think, where we're getting really stuck, and that's complicating efforts for real solidarity.
Yeah, definitely. You know, identity politics is important because we need to be able to address where there is disparate harm being done in different parts of society. So without Black Lives Matter saying Black Lives Matter, people don't see that the policing and the treatment of Black folks is disproportionately more fucked up than the lot of the rest of the population. Where we're hung up in identity politics is just the arrested development of all of us being stuck in this imprisonment of separation and oppressor versus victim and colonized versus colonizer. And there's a whole, you know, range of identity and social location that goes into how power is used in harmful ways. And so we can get stuck in the fighting against each other, which structurally is really only beneficial to the caste system. There's a really great book that dropped last year called Caste by Isabel Wilkerson. And it talks about how behind racism, there's the caste, which is really like the structure and the bones of the system, whereas the racism is the skin, and it's most powerful function as a program is to continue to distract us essentially from being able to address the caste, which is ancient. And the forms of a social disparity that we see now, a lot of, you know, racism is relatively new-ish. I mean, there's good debate on how far back racism as a construct actually goes. Anyways, we want to talk about how psychedelics can queer this conversation. So we have psychedelic experiences and it taps us into interconnectedness and seeing that, yes, I'm in this body, but I'm also spirit having a human experience and we need each other and we're family. These are the kind of experiences and awakenings that people can have with psychedelics. And although that doesn't always immediately translate to how we walk out in the world, in community that is working towards co-liberation and collective healing with psychedelic movement work, we can start to leverage the awakening and the expansion that psychedelics are helping us reach into coming into these conversations from perspectives that maybe have not been available to us because of how much trauma and disconnect and alienation and separation we've been suffering from. And we need that. We need that desperately so. I mean, how are we going to address the ecological crises and all the crises on top of the crises without first getting down to this real core crisis that we're reckoning with together, which is an identity crisis? I do really feel like the real big reckoning of our time is a reckoning of identity. Who are we? And we've created many of our identities based on colonial frames and dominant culture. You know, our identities, our cultural identities are colonial constructs. So how can we reclaim or renew what our identity is without bypassing anything? I'm in a white male body. I have a different experience than an indigenous person or someone who looks different than me. How can we look at that? How can psychedelics help us look at the ways that we're impacted differently in society and bring us to a place where we are able to, you know, be with differences, be with different experiences, and address the traumas that are held in our collective bonds and relationships and work through them in a way that doesn't perpetuate them.
Have you read Discourse on Colonialism, a Messier's book? Great book in understanding how the oppressor in these oppressive systems is also dehumanized by the system of oppression.
Yeah.
And so for white folks to awaken to that is very painful.
Yeah.
Psychedelic healing is very potent for this kind of pain. Psychedelics, in allowing us access to unity consciousness, helps manage these kind of reactive triggers that come up. And so when we think about healing and psychedelic healing, a big part of psychedelic healing is the ability to enter into these uncomfortable, unconscious spaces and heal them. And heal them by being present to them, feeling them, and living through the experience of feeling that. How that often shows up in psychedelic healing is in individual personal trauma and then ancestral trauma, but of one's personal lineage.
Yeah.
What we need to be doing is having conversations that expand this to collective healing. And you speak beautifully on this about healing the trauma within the relationship between different peoples, and especially the inheritors of European colonialism, which we both are inheritors of that colonialism. And so putting that kind of on the table to talk about this healing, and then I'd love for that to take us into the Right to Heal campaign.
Yeah. I share this story sometimes just because I think it speaks to the potential for what could be here. And I don't know how long this will take in America, but I know someone in Palestine who, long story short, he grew up being nonviolent direct action activist in Kingian lineage. And he, although he was studying nonviolence, he hated his oppressor. He hated Israelis. When he was in his teens, he went to Europe on some trip. He was pretty privileged relative to most Palestinians. And he, on this trip to Europe, he broke off from the group and visited Auschwitz. And he had a transformational experience because he could see the pain now of his oppressors. And then years later, he went and drank ayahuasca in Peru and had this vision of sitting in ceremony with Israelis and Palestinians. And he's doing that work now. And we need to work to not just have ceremony together, but to actually be able to be in space, to feel each other, to be able to harmonize our bodies, to build solidarity. First, it will start in relationships and building trust. And white folks have been privileged in being able to bypass, you know, looking at whiteness and white supremacy for so long. But that privilege is also a curse, because our liberation is bound up in each other. And I think that reframing is so vital, and something that psychedelic culture can offer is that there's, I'm sure you've heard the term white fragility. So that fragility is that aversion to being able to look at the truth, basically, and it triggers you. And I'm like, what if we framed white fragility as something to invite people into and celebrate the breaking of that edifice of the structure of a white identity, which is false? Yes, it's fragile. Break it.
That's good. Yes, it's fragile. Break it. And I think that white folks, I speak for myself, but I think that we want to feel like good people. And so instead of doing the work that makes us feel like bad people, as part of that work is like having to confront that, we often will virtue signal instead. And that's like the white guilt kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's something like I didn't want to do in this conversation, and I don't really want to do. And it makes me disengage with certain conversations about this. Is like, well, it seems like virtue signaling is the tool that's available for us to say, okay, well, I'm a good white person because I know the language and I know how to speak in these ways. But what that does is that perpetuates the separation, because it isn't a true meeting. And this is something I just want to own. Like, I'm not there yet of the true meeting. And that's part of why I'm so interested in this conversation. And I want to get to the right to heal, and I want to be really solution oriented. And as we look at the right to heal, as we look at the legislation that's coming through around the psychedelic movement, for those of us who are using psychedelics for healing trauma and for training up our ability to sit with discomfort, what action do we take right now? What is the action, both on a legislative level, how we can put pressure on certain legislative initiatives, but also in our own lives? Let's talk about our solutions.
Yeah, let's do that. So the Right to Heal campaign is Spore's impending public education campaign. It's very—
What is Spore, real quick? Just a brief note on Spore.
Yes, Spore is the Society for Psychedelic Outreach, Reform, and Education. We're a community organizing and media education platform focused on promoting essentially community sovereignty, but community health and wealth, equity and justice, responsible stewardship with psychedelics and community. And the Right to Heal campaign is a public education campaign that is really from the ground up. We want to use the data and research and parts of the mainstream narrative that are really opening up a broader receptivity to psychedelics, but we also see the need to open up the idea of what healing even is. Currently, the mainstream narrative is very medicalized and individualized in our understanding of healing with psychedelics or just healing in general. But healing and holisticness can't be separated. And holisticity is addressing systems, not just symptoms. And so we, with the Right to Heal campaign, want to open up to a collective narrative of healing that are looking at all of these different interconnected parts that can be addressed with holistic policy reform or just holistic organizing, more in process than just the outcome of changing the law. And also bringing to the fold many different perspectives on what healing is and what relationships with psychedelics can look like and should be accepted and protected. And so the real call to action that we need, that the Right to Heal is calling for, is for all of us to stand in solidarity in our sovereignty. And I believe that real solidarity is where sovereignty and interdependence meet. And different people from different walks and different communities have different ways and have different needs. And people and communities know best what they need to heal and be well. The medical industrial complex and the therapeutic industrial complex is a product of a white society. And to only grant access to psychedelics in that structure is actually horribly violent to many communities who don't have cultural relevance or actually have historical epigenetic trauma embedded in that structure. We have to recognize that the right to heal is not just about the right to have access. It's about choosing our relationships, choosing our healing path. We have to be able to choose our healing. And that can only happen in community stewardship. And that does not disclude the need for the medical therapeutic model at all. There is a need for just a braiding and a marriage there. But yeah, right now I would say for listeners, just considering what I'm saying and doing homework, learning our history.
Can we direct to some resources for that homework? I know you've studied a lot. What would be a great access point for someone who's heard this conversation?
I'll go with what's fresh, like recently read. The book, My Grandmother's Hands by Reshma Monacham, I feel is a very important book for these times and for the psychedelic movement. And it speaks to the difference in how different bodies hold trauma differently. And he doesn't cover everyone in the book, but he focuses specifically on white bodies, black bodies, and police bodies, actually, and provides frames for how we can create space for the healing that needs to be held within those identity groups, but then also towards in doing that work that's more within the container of an identity or of a community towards the healing that can happen between communities. So there's that. The other books that we've mentioned, Emergent Strategy and CAST today, but there's people who are doing this sort of work out with psychedelic who I really feel like are really helping shape narrative in a holistic way. Ancestors Project, a lot coming out through Decrim Nature. I see great stuff coming from Chacruna often. I honestly, to your question on like where would I recommend people go, there's not a whole lot that I'm aware of when it pertains to medicine that I've read that I'd personally recommend people to look into on this subject. Like, how do we start to develop an understanding of our relationship with psychedelics and the psychedelic movement as part of a solidarity, part of the larger collective healing and liberation movement ecosystem? And I think because that marriage hasn't, you know, quite happened, the psychedelic movement emerged at the same time as the civil rights movement. And I think it's interesting that this reemergence of the psychedelic movement corresponded with the explosion of the movement for Black lives. You know, in 2020, that was sending shockwaves around the world. The psychedelic movement was also, you know, reemerging. And the psychedelic movement of the 60s was a big part of the civil rights movement. That's why the Controlled Substances Act addressed drugs that were associated with the anti-war left and hippies, and then the Nixon administration's other big enemy, which was black people, to really further separate and disrupt and destroy those groups. And so, yeah, I mean, I think just learning our history is key, but also just being in community and speaking towards the need for us to create culturally relevant and not just access, but real equity, which is It's equity is not just access, it's shared stewardship. I think there's this social justice idea of equity that's like often ironically kind of more about getting a piece of the system that wants to be dismantled, or that someone who's wanting that equity kind of wants to transform the system but can actually codify it by just fighting for a certain idea of justice and equity within it. And then there's like the capitalist idea of equity, which is like shared ownership. I think a holistic idea of understanding of equity is shared stewardship, is shared responsibility. And there needs to be work to address inequities to even build those capacities in communities. And a lot of that right now, the struggle there is with policy. Policy will set the groundwork for what this will look like and what where blocks and limits to access will be and what people will be left out. Making sure that the work that's being done and wherever you live around policy right now, because this is the sort of groundwork phase that we're in as a movement, is really held accountable to community and is involving especially the most impacted and the most historically marginalized, and not just involving, but really centering leadership from those communities to make sure that there's sovereignty and communities being able to steward and hold healing and create healing within communities. That is the process of our collective healing, is just taking that stand together.
So Duffy, to land our conversation today, you had told me, and I think you're absolutely correct, that Colorado is the epicenter of the movement for psychedelic policy reform, for drug policy reform at this moment. There's initiatives in California, and I think Washington as well. Washington?
There's initiatives all over, but for statewide, I think only California, Michigan coming up,
Michigan,
and Colorado coming up.
Yeah. So yeah. You had said that Colorado was the epicenter. And as the United States goes, so to the UN, the world, a lot of, well, at least the way that the initial criminalization went was like the US leadership. So I think we can safely say that what happens in Colorado is going to be effective throughout the world. So with an eye to the fact that our listeners are global, what should we all know about legislation in Colorado, and what can we do? Do we call senators? Do we contribute money to certain initiatives? For those of us who are hip to the right to heal and want to see decriminalization and appropriate regulation that factors in all of these disparate needs that we've discussed over this conversation today, what do we need to know about this legislation, and what can we do to forward it in a good way?
Yeah, thank you. So it's not grandiose to say that Colorado it'll be an epicenter. In one sense, there's a struggle between the therapeutic medical aspect of the movement and then the more like grassroots, more interested in liberty and personal and community sovereignty. And that tension, I see it as natural, has yet to find its marriage where that synergy is really met. So Colorado looks like right now, and by the time you drop this podcast, it'll be a sure thing. It looks like we're going to have a ballot initiative for full decriminalization of a group of psychedelics and another ballot initiative for a regulatory framework coming together at the same time. So that hasn't happened anywhere yet. That's why I said that I feel like Colorado will be the epicenter, because that dynamic, that central tension that's in the movement, there's an opportunity for that to be worked out and find a cooperative way forward, which is what we hope to support with S4. And we need a recognition of what's happening at the state and local level does impact the entire ecosystem, especially at this critical early stage phase. And it's not just about the laws in Colorado. Like, this is about our compass as a movement. This is about the narrative and conceptual understandings and our analysis of what is needed and what's going on here. And it's also about it is about power, and that's what politics are. There's a need to restore trust and restore power to the people, to communities, to make sure that the grassroots movement can really find power with establishment political structures. And I think that that's the mycelial way. It's no longer going along with the end-old warring of domination and wanting to overcome and then dominate the ones who were dominated before, now are the dominators. It's finding power with to compost and regenerate systems. And that is something that if Colorado is going to be an experiment for where that sort of work is really going down, we can, all of the support that we can get is essential from around the country for people to lift up what's going to be happening next year in Colorado, to call attention to it, the work that we're doing, the work that there's a coalition here that Spore has activated and is stewarding called the My Coalition, because we just love our mushroom puns. And that work, the work of the people, will be empowered by increased visibility and awareness. And so, yeah, simply just sharing. Of course, donations are always welcome. You can donate to thespore.org/donate. What I really want to call people to consider and step into is not just standing for your access. Don't just stand for the drugs that you want or the world that you want. Stand for everybody's right and capacity to heal, to shape their own destinies, to create a thriving world where all of us can belong and contribute, and our visions can make up shared collective visions together. And especially those of us who have more power and privilege in the established social structures, consider those who are often most marginalized and left out. And I think that the psychedelic movement wants to see, most of us want to see thriving communities. I think all of us really want that. We want to live in thriving communities. We want to live amongst happy people. We want to belong. We want love. So yeah, you know, this is really just about spreading love. I think that that's actually what decolonization is. It's really spreading love. So step into the mycelial way, become a Jedi, and please do also reach out to thespore.org. We have a little section on our website. You can just send us questions and email us, and we'd love to connect if you're interested in contributing to this work in any way.
Beautiful, beautiful. I completely agree, and I feel like I have my education. We all have our education to continue with, and you've dropped a lot of gems today. I want to read My Grandmother's Hands.
Yeah.
That book has popped up here and there, and it definitely seems like it's a great starting place or continuing place for those of us who are looking to expand our understanding. Well, I am very grateful to have your wisdom on the show, and I love the serendipity of chance meetings. I mean, you and your work has been on my radar somewhat, but I wasn't fully aware of the depth of your understanding and bringing this mycelial perspective, which expands my understanding and my ability to participate and lend my voice and my work to support of this beautiful process of collective liberation, which we talk about life as a festival. The beautiful thing about a festival is that a proper participatory festival environment, we really are all there together. We're there to celebrate, but we're also there to heal, and we're also there to participate, to serve, to be connected. And I think that while, as with everything, there are hypocrisies that abound within the Burning Man community or transformational festival culture, there are also models for the beautiful world we know is possible.
Absolutely.
And as we deepen our responsibility and commitment to healing for all, we're closer to making that world possible, and far closer to making that world possible than running away to create our own private utopias, which is exactly anathema to the healing that we need, that will actually and tangibly lead to our own personal liberation, because I am because you are, and I am wounded because you are wounded, mm-hmm. and I am anxious and depressed and alienated because you are anxious and depressed and alienated. It's not going to be a ketamine treatment that changes that.
Yeah.
It's not even going to be an ayahuasca ceremony that changes that.
That's right.
Going to be action in the world
and
co-liberation that's going to change that. And it is changing that and will continue to change that by increasing our awareness, not by elevating away from struggle, but by bringing our consciousness into the murky spaces, into the messy spaces, and finding our co-liberators there who maybe didn't look like we thought they would look like, but actually allow us to see that we don't look like what we thought we looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, we rise together.
Woo. I mean, I kind of want to leave you with that last word, but I'll just say that so beautiful. And yes, we're not suffering because of a lack of access to mushrooms. We're suffering because of that alienation, and the mushrooms are here to help. And they're reaching out, and ayahuasca and other medicines, they reach out as we reach out. And we have responsibility. And when this threat has kind of been whispered throughout this conversation, that the medicines aren't going to do it for us. That's bypassing. Watch out. But the medicines can help us walk our walk. And everybody's tripping. We're learning how to walk it off. And being the medicine and having a relationship with medicines and with each other, as these are sacred partnerships. We need each other. And we all have a shared responsibility and our work, and what that is different for different folks, but we all have a place and a sacred purpose. And I believe we're basically a sacred mission. We are a prayer. And so we all have that belonging that we can tap into, and we do it in community. I graduated from Naropa in Boulder, and we read something once that, you know, talked about the third Buddha as being the Sangha.
Mm, yeah, I love that.
The third Buddha will be the Sangha. So beloved community, this is what we came here for, and we can start there. The utopias that are far out and away, they keep us distracted from the beloved community that's right here in front of us, that we just need to give ourselves to and to lean into and create together. It's here now.
It's here right now, in this room, in this moment, and continues. Duffy, thank you for your time. Thanks for being here on Life is a Festival. And thanks so much for offering your perspective of what this podcast could appear to others as. It's a bit by design that way.
Thanks, Andy.
We bring them in, and then we get a little deeper. And we got a lot deeper today. And thanks to your wisdom and your work. And I look forward to seeing how this unfolds in Colorado and throughout the nation. And all of the listeners here, we're going to be doing what we can to forward this in a good way. Yeah. Thanks to your work and all of your colleagues. It's been an honor to speak with you.
Thank you, Eamon. Yeah, you as well. It's been a joy and a pleasure. I love what you're doing. Keep hosting these containers and querying the narratives.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you like the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.